Hope you're having a great day, and thank you for checking in. Coming up in just a few moments, a chat with Kevin Thompson, the star quarterback at Sacramento State. The Hornets are having a great year in the top 25 for the first time since 2011, and a major showdown homecoming game with Montana. But first, a conversation with Bobby Wineapple, San Francisco acting coach and big-time sports fan. How's it going?
It's going just great. This is my favorite time of year. We got all the sports teams going, and we're getting ready for the World Series. I'm a happy man.
You've made your mark as an acting coach, but being a sports fan may have saved your life when we look at the anniversary of the Loma Prieta earthquake, October 17, 1989.
Yeah, I'm sure like everybody else, I remember that day well, and I was sitting in front of my TV watching the game at 5 o'clock because I had rushed home from work. At that time, I used to work in Fremont and lived in Berkeley. And normally I'd probably be coming through the Cypress Freeway area around 5 o'clock, which wouldn't have been good if I'd been doing it that day. But on that day, maybe it saved my life because I started home early so I could watch the game.
At what point did you see the damage and look at that freeway and say, oh my God, that could have been me?
Yeah, you know, it actually took a couple of hours before I realized what had happened because all the power was out in my house. TV jumped off of the stand and landed upside down and snapped off the antenna. We had antennas back then. And
dating yourself.
Yeah, I know, 1989. And I didn't know what was happening. And I quickly checked in with my wife. I called her up and she answered. She was working in San Francisco and said, I'm okay. We hung up. And I saw some smoke coming from downtown Berkeley, about a couple miles from where I live. So I got on my bike and I went down to see what was happening. And I thought it was just kind of a tumbler, nothing too big. And someone was standing there and said the Bay Bridge collapsed. And at that moment, I realized it was much bigger than I thought it was. And then I started finding out, probably even an hour after the original, the first quake, what had actually happened, and realized the Cypress Freeway was down. So it was a while before I realized what was happening. We had no power.
Did you have a rooting interest at that time, whether it be Giants or A's for the World Series?
I was split on that one. I was impressed with what the A's were doing, obviously. It was great. I had been a Giants fan. I've got New York roots, so I was a little bit, leaning on the Giants. But I don't remember having a strong preference at that time, but I was happy to have both of our hometown teams in the series, that's for sure.
You're like one of those soft Northern California fans, like they have in New York, right? Because you could wear that half Yankee, half Met hat.
That's never going to happen, David. You never see someone saying, I like the Mets and the Yankees. You had to be one or the other, very different world. And I grew up a Mets fan. My grandma lived actually not far from Shea Stadium. So, you had to root. I was 10 years old in 1969. You had to root for the Miracle Mets. And I always thought, the Yankees were like rooting for, Goliath to beat David in the Bible. And so I was a Mets fan all the way and just thought, oh, the Yankees have all the money and they've got all the resources. We're going to, you got to shoot for the underdog. So I learned to root for the underdog. And it was a great time because we had another great underdog in 69, which was the New York Jets with Joe Namath, and he was the upstart, and so all of that was happening when I was 10 years old, and learned to root for the underdog when you're a kid in New York at that point.
What about the starting five for the Knicks, early 70s?
Oh man, yeah. Well, so even starting earlier in 69, I don't know exactly the year they had my favorite starting five, but they had Walt Frazier and Earl the Pearl Monroe in the front court, in the back court as guards. And then they had two of my favorite forwards. They had Bill Bradley and Dave DeBuscher in front. And in the middle, they had Willis Reed. And don't forget on the bench, you could have Dick Barnett come in the back court. And you also had Jerry Lucas, who could sort of play power forward or center. And he had what now would be a three-pointer. He would shoot from way beyond the three-point line, Jerry Lucas. But, of course, in those days, it was only worth 2 points.
Do you remember Earl the Pearl Monroe's nickname?
All I remember is the Pearl. Was there another one?
Black Jesus.
Oh, no. That's right. I've forgotten about that. Very good.
And he was a playground legend. I remember seeing one of those old documentaries, back in the 70s, and that dude was the man.
Oh, yeah, he was something else. I'll tell you who else I got to see in the early 70s. I lived on Long Island near the Nassau Coliseum, And I would go see the ABA. A lot of people have forgotten about them. And we had the New York Nets and Julius Erving, and I got to see him live. And I will never forget, David, watching him live. He basically picked his dribble up at half court, and it looked like he took two steps and dunked the ball from midcourt. I mean, that's how big his wingspan was. He seemed to fly through the air. That was, you know, to see him live was, a thing of beauty.
With enormous hands.
Enormous hands, and just, he was graceful like a gazelle. He was beautiful to watch.
There's a book you got to read about the ABA. It's by Terry Pluto called Loose Balls. And it documents that whole era, this kind of, renegade league and all the stuff behind the scenes and great anecdotes with the players. George McGinnis smoking, on the bench during games. I mean, it's classic. You got to read that.
Love it. I'll get it.
One of the things that's the biggest story locally in the NFL, Bobby, is the 49ers 5-0. Are you a believer at this point?
Wow. Just a couple of weeks ago, I thought it was a bit of a fluke. And, of course, they haven't played, some real contending teams. But last week, I got to say, that defense, they were stifling. And, they made the Rams look like a bad team. And the Rams are not a bad team. I got to tell you, I go way back with the 49ers. I moved out here in 1982 from New York. And so I got to see the Montana years. I got to see a lot of the Steve Young years. And, I've been a 49ers fan. I love the red and gold. But it wasn't until last week that I started going, we might have something going on this year.
Would you compare their defense with some of the great ones they've ever had? You go back to maybe Harbaugh's 2012 team or those Ronnie Lott defensively led teams?
Wow, that's a pretty tough comparison there. I'm not sure I'm going to go there yet. Let's wait a few more games. What do you think? You're gonna start comparing that?
Well, I do think we need to pump the brakes a little bit because it's only been five games and the small sample size.
Yeah,
But you like the personnel. That front seven is really good, in particular the front four, and Bosa is tremendous.
Absolutely. Yep. And well coached, you can see that they're all playing on the same page. So it's a reason to go back down to Santa Clara for the first time in a while.
Is the quarterback play enough for you to say, hey, this is a championship contending team?
He's going to have to play above his head. I grew up watching Joe Namath. I've watched Joe Montana. I've watched Steve Young. You're not going to say Garoppolo's in that league, but, it's a team game. And if people, all come together and get on the same page and they're all well coached, they could play above their heads. But that's a tall order.
Well, who in the NFC, I'm looking at Green Bay with one loss. New Orleans has really played well, even after Drew Brees went down in the first week with Teddy Bridgewater at quarterback. And there's no super team in the NFC that you say, well, hey, they can't beat them.
No, I know. Well, that's the interesting thing this year is that there is an opening. There's a place for them. In some other years, we would have said, oh, obviously there's a powerhouse, but we haven't got that right now in the NFC, have we?
No.
Football is one of those any given Sunday things where I've seen a lot of things. I got to go to a lot of Super Bowls. My dad was friends with Pete Rozelle back in the day. So I've been to a whole bunch of Super Bowls and gotten to see a lot of big games. Saw the 1988 Dolphins 49ers game right here at Stanford. And, Been really fortunate to be in the stands for some good football.
What was your most memorable Super Bowl?
Well, let's see. I guess there was the Stanford one, probably just because we were home here in the Bay Area, and it wasn't a very close game, of course, but it was Montana at his, I got there early and I watched him warm up. I used to like doing that when I was a kid with Joe Namath and watch these guys warm up, and they would throw 30 yard down and outs. They'd have a big rack of balls and just throw one after the other, and they'd have somebody going out, go down 20, 30 yards and do a button hook or just cut over, and they would throw one strike right after another, dozens, and hit the guy right between the numbers every time. And I remember Namath doing that. And, the ball had no arc. It was a 30-yard spiral bullet. And I remember watching Montana do that in the warm-ups and thinking, you know, this is once in a generation.
As a fan of all those sports growing up, was there one guy that maybe captured your imagination and said, you know what, I wish I could be him for a day?
You know who I really loved? I really loved Bill Bradley. I don't know if you know that great book that John McPhee wrote about him called A Sense of Where You Are, but it's a wonderful book about Bill Bradley. And I loved Bill Bradley's intelligence. And, you know, I love to play. I'm under 6 feet, and I'm usually the smallest guy in the court when we play a pickup game. So I always had to learn how to be smart, how to make the good pass, how to look ahead, how to, you know, really think about being a playmaker. And for me, I always appreciated the intelligence of Bill Bradley. And also in his book, he said, you know, when I'm practicing by myself in the gym and it's getting late and I'm getting tired and I'm about to turn in and quit, I think to myself, right now, somewhere in some other gym is some other guy and he's not quitting.
Yeah.
And I will face him. And then he played, and then he practiced another hour or two. And I always remember that whenever I'd practice and I'd get tired, I'd think, somewhere right now, someone else is practicing. And if I turn in, he's going to beat me. So Bill Bradley was real influential and, you know, obviously went on to a, you know, another great career in politics and everything. But his intelligence and his playmaking on the court, that was always a role model for me.
Yeah, Rhodes Scholar out of Princeton.
Exactly.
Now, one guy I remember watching that would outwork everybody for me locally, Steve Nash at Santa Clara, he was a guy that would shame his teammates into working too. So he'd call the manager like at midnight, open up the gym. They all play pickup games. And because of him and that kind of nonstop gym rat work ethic, they made the NCAA tournament 3 times in a span of
four years.
And that's the last time they made it. With me doing the games back in 1995. So you see what a work ethic and a drive can do for not just an individual, but for an entire team.
Yeah, that's exactly the kind of player I'm talking about, Steve Nash. You know, the playmaker, the guy who sees, you know, everything down the court before it even develops. You know, that must have been fun for you calling those games and watching him.
That was the last year. My first year was his senior year. And you kind of get spoiled like, oh, I do college basketball. I go to the NCAA tournament every year. And you get to, you know, go to all these great places and watch a team win 25 games. That was the last year they've made the tournament. So that's 24 years ago, and have been floundering for the last several years. So you need a transcendent player to come back to the South Bay again.
Yeah. Well, it feels like, you know, in the Steph Curry era, there's more emphasis being placed on playmaking and good passing and, you know, really good shooting. You remember there have been some periods in the 80s and 90s where it felt like everybody's playing iso ball or just posting up down low.
Very boring to watch.
Yeah, you know, and I'm, you know, just this iso ball thing. I mean, I don't know, have you seen any of the preseason stuff with Russell Westbrook and James Harden playing together?
Wondering if that's going to work with one basketball.
Yeah, exactly. That's just not my kind of, you know, again, growing up with the 69 Knicks, you know, you watch people who play smart ball and really knew how to, you know, how to execute. And that's to me, that's what makes basketball exciting, is it's a team sport, not an iso, you know, thing. Yeah.
I know you can't root for the Yankees, but can you at least step back as a fan and say, all right, they've got a chance to beat Houston or they're done?
Oh, no, I you know, I respect the Yankees, and I've started to soften a little bit on my David and Goliath, you know, stance. It's just, you know, when I was growing up, it was always either or. But now, I think Aaron Judge is a great player. I respect their, you know, I respect everything they're doing. And I'm not going to go so far as to say I'm rooting for them, but I'd love to see it go to 7. Obviously, Houston is, you know, loaded with talent, and that starting pitching, geez, you know. But I respect the Yankees, and I'm happy to watch them compete.
Hey, how did you get, I mean, you're a pretty knowledgeable sports fan. You got a great history in these games. How did you make this transition from a guy that's a sports nut, wannabe guard, to a thespian?
Yeah, you know, when I was a teenager, I actually had a couple of years where I thought I could compete. And, you know, when I was 12, 13, 14, I played Little League. And, you know, I had a cannon of an arm and I could hit, and I was fast and smart. And I actually thought I might play for a while. I didn't have much support at home. My parents had split up, and, you know, it's something interesting. I imagine most athletes probably had some parental or adult guidance and support at that age, and I just didn't have it. You know, even just getting to the games
was
a challenge for me when I was 13. So I gave it up, you know, when I was a teenager. And my grandparents were musicians. And, you know, they bought me a guitar for my 14th birthday, and I just started falling in love with music. And so I keep playing pickup games and things like that, but I wasn't quite as serious about it. And then music just took over as the love of my life. And I let go of my professional athlete sports dreams. But, you know, here I am in my sixth decade, and I still play every Sunday morning with a bunch of guys out in Alameda. And we play a good 3-on-3 or 4-on-4 pickup game. And I still love to play.
Do you still call fouls that don't exist to get the ball back?
You know, it's funny. I don't even think about it, because I played street ball in New York, and you know, you had to get bowled over to call a foul. Like, you know, so it was kind of a little bit of a macho thing that you didn't call fouls. So I still don't call them that much, because, you know, I just consider the body contact part of the game. But you know, other guys are like, "Hey, you bumped me a little," and they call a foul, and I'm like, "Sure, you can have the ball."
Yeah.
Here's one thing I learned early on. I never argue with a call, ever. You respect the call.
But you have played with guys that, because they miss a shot, they'll call a foul.
Well, you know, there's that.
Give me a couple of movie reviews on your way out. You know, something I should see. I did see the Jennifer Lopez movie Hustlers, which I thought was just okay. What should I see out there and why?
Wow, what's out there? You know what? I'm a little behind right now. I haven't seen anything I really loved lately. I've been watching some documentaries lately. I love a good documentary. And I think there's something happening in the world of documentaries, which is they're using the narrative storytelling art form and doing documentaries in that way, which I think is really an interesting trend in documentary filmmaking. There's a great documentary called Biggest Little Farm. And it's the story, actually, of a filmmaker who quits the world of filmmaking in L.A., moves up to Ventura County, and starts a farm. It's a beautifully made documentary. So that's something I saw lately. You know, I could talk about my favorite movies from back in the day forever. Not sure I've seen anything that I would jump out of my seat for in the past few months other than that documentary, Biggest Little Farm. Great movie.
Any series on Netflix or Amazon you like a Fleabag, which I just love.
Yeah, sure. I you know, I'm not a violent man. I'm a man of peace, but I do love Ozark. Very violent. Waiting for the next season of Ozark. I don't know if you're familiar with that.
Oh yeah, but, Jason Bateman.
Great. Yeah, Jason Bateman, and I love Laura Linney. I think she's doing a great job, both of them in that. So Ozark has really got me. I'm on the third season of Goliath. I'm, you know, not quite sure yet if I'm going to recommend it, but I do always enjoy watching Billy Bob Thornton. I think he's a very relaxed actor, never pushes, and you and I've talked a little bit about acting, about that effortless quality of just, you feel like someone's not acting, just being completely inside the character without working too hard. I enjoy Billy Bob Thornton's work.
Who else do you like as an actor?
Oh boy, get me started.
Give me your top two. Two men, two women.
Wow. Okay. I'm going to give you one that a lot of people don't know. And her name is Juliet Stevenson. Now, she's a goddess in England, and she's a stage actress. And she's in a movie a lot of people haven't seen here, Anthony Minghella's first directorial film. It's called Truly, Madly, Deeply. Superb film. In England, she's thought of as one of the absolute top actresses, but she's never made a big name here in America. So anything you can catch her in, I think, is great. I love Alan Rickman, who's also in Truly, Madly, Deeply. My training is, you know, I've spent some time in England, and I guess I have a soft spot for the British actors, but I love the way a lot of the British actors handle language and don't push emotionally and just feel, I love language. I really love language. So people like Ian McKellen and Bane Kingsley and Patrick Stewart, I just love the way the Brits handle language. Anthony Hopkins, these guys. And on the female side, people like Judi Dench, Maggie Smith. So I've named a whole bunch of British actors there on my list. How about that?
Can you give me a couple of Americans? Do we make the cut at all on your list, Bobby?
Well, there's certainly some great ones. I mean, I've always been obsessed with the movie The Godfather, like a lot of people. And if you just watch, you know, part one scene after another, each and every scene, just, you know, one right after another, beautiful. And, you know, obviously Pacino's work and Marlon Brando's work. Fredo, the youngest brother, is played by John Cazale. Or maybe it's pronounced Cazale. And a lot of people don't know him. He died pretty young. He only made about four films. Pretty much every movie he was in was nominated for multiple Oscars. And if you ask people like Al Pacino and Meryl Streep what it was like to work with him, they said, there are some actors who make everyone in a film better. And John Cazale was one of them. And there's a great documentary about him and his life and his work as an actor called I Always Knew It Was You. Which is the line, you know, Pacino says to him in Godfather Part Two. So John Cazale, he's a bit of an unknown to some people and only made about four or five films, but really a gold standard. He's sort of the actor's actor.
That's a great sports metaphor, right? The guy that makes everybody else better around him.
Yeah, that's great. That's a good point, David. You know, who are the people who've been on teams that seem, obviously we know how coaches and managers can do that, but who's someone that seems to, every team they're on, seems to get better because they, you know, people like Jackie Robinson, who just, you know, embodied the game, right? Lou Brock, you know, people who just, they hustled, they played the game the right way. People like Willie Mays, you know, you must have a couple of sports figures that you feel like every team they were on was better because of them.
Someone like Steve Kerr, who's around winners all the time, you know, that was
Chicago
and San Antonio, and of course, as a coach.
Pretty much everything Steve Kerr has touched has, you know, turned into a ring. So that can't be a coincidence.
Yeah. Not always the best guy, but just someone that brings that something to the table.
Yeah. 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 Steve Kerr, boy, what a great guy. And now he's got all the political stuff going on and all kinds of other things he's mixed up in.
Well, that's one thing I noticed with whether it's been him or players that we didn't have before, where guys would be willing to speak up on issues that mattered, where Michael Jordan, Tiger Woods, they never commented on anything. You know, it was all about protecting their image.
I respect that if people don't want to speak, but I do have to say I believe that a sports figure has every right to speak their mind and speak out against justice and injustice. And if I agree with them or don't agree with them, I would never challenge their right to speak out. I always respect that, and I think it's important that people say what they want to say.
I respect your right to jump up and speak and say what you want to say. Hey, we're going to do this again, and I want to sure we get in plenty of sports and plenty of movies because you got a lot of different interests, and we'll talk more about the acting stuff as well next time, if that's all right with you.
Absolutely.
I enjoyed it. We're going to make this a regular thing. Bobby Wineapple on The D-Lew Show.
Sounds great, David. Good to talk with you.
Thanks so much to Bobby Wineapple. Now turning to football. Sacramento State, one of the great stories in FCS play. A year ago, 0-7 in the Big Sky. This year, ranked in the top 20 for the first time since 2011. Their quarterback is Kevin Thompson, the Big Sky Offensive Player of the Week, who has accounted for 10 touchdowns over the last 2 weeks. 6 passing, 4 rushing. Had a chance to catch up with Kevin and ask him about the comfort level with the offense.
Oh, I feel extremely confident and really comfortable back there, and that's a testament. Big props to the O-line up front. They're giving me all day. You know, I'm not getting sacked. I'm able to go through my progressions and not feel rushed, not really getting anyone in my face, and that just makes things a lot easier. And then, of course, the guys out wide are making plays, and their backs are blocking for me in the run game. So I think we're just executing at a really high level right now, and everyone feels really confident and good about the game.
That said, at a high level, how much better can you guys get in that area?
I think we can there's still a lot of room for improvement. Just the little things that we want to continue to improve on, just getting lined up in the right spots, getting the right blocks, staying you know, consistent with my progressions, just little things. You know, you can never play a perfect game. There's always going to be something to improve on. So even when it looks like, you know, we're being really efficient and playing at a high level, there's always something.
Yeah, you were a little kid the last time Sac State was ranked, 2011. What's it mean to you and the guys to crack the top 25?
Oh, shoot. 2011, I would have been like a freshman or sophomore in high school, because I'm one of the old guys. But, no, it feels good. The ranking doesn't mean much to us until the end of the season, obviously. You know, so we're really just focused on today and the next practice and getting ready for Montana. It's a good story, definitely, for the fans to talk about. And I think it gets more people excited that we're ranked. But that's something that we don't really want to look into too much as a team, because at the end of the day, it doesn't mean anything until the playoff bracket comes out.
Yeah, I know Coach Taylor's motto is humble and hungry, so stay focused on the next practice, the next play, the next game, and not get too far ahead. That said, what's the excitement level like around the campus when we got a pretty good football team around here?
Yeah, I think people are getting real excited about coming to the games, which is great. And you know, we love playing in front of a good crowd. I love playing in front of the crowds that we have now. Hopefully we can get some more people out there, but I enjoy it regardless of how many we get. But yeah, it's definitely getting some buzz and whatnot, which is cool. But yeah, we're really just focused on what we need to do as a team and make sure we keep going out there and playing good football and coming home with a win.
Without giving out too much of the game plan and what I saw at practice today, what about the Montana game and what they do well defensively and the things that you can attack?
Yeah, they got some really good players. They're really good tacklers. You know, they're not going to miss a lot of tackles, so that you have to be even more efficient and make sure you're playing at a really high level, because these guys aren't going to make a ton of mistakes. So you got to take what they give you and you know, not try to do too much. Just stick to the game plan and stick to the progression and just play hard.
And you got a history with some of these Montana folks. You go back with Bobby mm-hmm. Houck recruiting you to UNLV. What do you recall about that time and Coach Houck?
Yeah, it was getting recruited by Coach Houck was great. He's a great guy. Still, you know, obviously we don't really talk, but I still say I have a really good relationship with him. When I saw him at the Big Sky Media Days, he was, you know, as happy as ever to see me, and he's, you know, asking about the folks and stuff. So I have a lot of respect for Coach Houck, and obviously because he gave me my shot to play Division I college football. So, you know, I'm always going to be thankful for him, and I think he's a great coach. So, you know, really good recruiter, really good guy. So, yeah, I think I have a really good relationship with him still.
Kevin Thompson of Sac State with us. And you go back to your time there, UNLV, you had all the elbow issues, and mm-hmm. you're wondering if you're going to play again and if anyone is going to want you, right?
Yeah.
What's it like now for you to know that you've got – we talked about this off-air, that you got 2 years to get this done.
Yeah, and it's a blessing because, I mean, it allows me to continue on and do graduate school, and just – it's going to open more doors for me. But, yeah, it's just been great being here, just – being able to find Sacramento State, it was just a crazy process, honestly. But you know, I'm really thankful to be here. I love Sacramento. I love this school and what it's been able to give me. And you know, hopefully I'll be able to give back to it at some point. But you know, it's been great. I love it.
Yeah, you're giving a lot here with this football program.
Trying,
Kevin. When you had those times where you're wondering if I'm going to play, and if so, where? Who did you turn to, you know, during that time when you're wondering about your playing career?
Yeah, it was my parents and really specifically my dad, because you know, he wasn't gonna let me give up, wasn't gonna let me quit. He's pretty tough on me, but he made sure I got out there and trained and did my rehab and made sure I wasn't taking days off or getting down on myself. Both my parents were always just telling me, like, we believe in you. We've seen, you know, how talented you are. So even when I didn't really believe it myself, I was able to have my folks there. You know, they had my back, and they were just kind of pushing me through it all. And, you know, a couple times that through the rehab process, I was questioning, like, do I want to play? Is this for me? And, you know, I was like, man, I just really want to make my pops proud. So I'm just going to stick with it. And I'm really thankful for him for, you know, making me push through everything and all the hard times.
Yeah, now maybe you don't think about it during the game or just before, but are you playing for them?
Oh, yeah, definitely. Part of me. I'd say I'm playing for myself, playing for my team, playing for my parents, playing for, you know, my friends, just because I've had such a great support system, you know, growing up and through my whole football career, and even through the injury. You know, my friends and my family were always there for me, and no one ever really gave up on me. People were always saying, you know, we believe in you, you're going to do great things, like even when I wasn't doing anything, when I wasn't even enrolled in school. So I just play for them, and obviously I love the game, so I'm playing for myself too. And then just playing with these guys is just a ton of fun right now. You know, we're having a blast. Locker room's fun, and everyone just really confident right now. So, man, couldn't ask for a better situation to be in.
You were part of this program last year that dropped 7 straight to end the year, and now part of this amazing turnaround. When coaches talk about culture change and players talk about that too, what does that mean to you, and how have things changed this year with Coach Taylor?
We really just bought in as a team, I think, to the change. Obviously, when big change happens, sometimes there could be some pushback by some of the guys. People could be really unsure. But we just all said, hey, let's just buy in, do what the coaches say. You know, we were pretty much at the bottom last year. Can't get, you know, too much worse from there. Why not just buy in and give it everything we got and trust these guys? They have a heck of a pedigree coaching. They've done great things at really high levels. So at least for me personally, I was like, man, I'm just gonna buy in, trust Coach Taylor, trust all these guys that he brought in, because, you know, he's done good things at a high level. So, and quarterbacks have played well under him. So, you know, and I think everyone else followed suit. Everyone else bought in. So just having a ton of fun.
Yeah, I know he told me that he wanted to show everybody how much he loves football and get these kids to love football again. Do you feel like that's part of what's going on in this locker room?
Definitely. You know, when you're losing, you know, it can be tough. It can be tough to get to practice, and it really tests your motivation. It's really good learning experience to lose. As much as you don't want to do it, I think it was
sucks.
great learning experience though for me personally, and I think for us as a team. You know, because now we're getting a small taste of success. We don't want to be complacent. We don't want to end up, you know, back where we were. So, but yeah, we're just having a ton of fun. I think the mindset just around the program and around the way we attack practice and treat games, it's a lot different. We understand it's a game at the end of the day. So we're just having a lot of fun with it. We don't put too much pressure on ourselves, and Coach Taylor doesn't put too much pressure on us. He just expects us to do what we need to do and to make sure we execute the game plan. And when we do that, we have a lot of fun.
Yeah, this is a lot of fun watching you, Kevin. Good luck the rest of the
way. Appreciate it. Thank you.
Sacramento State with a massive game coming up against Montana, maybe the biggest home game in school history. Thank you so much to Kevin Thompson and our first guest, Bobby Wineapple. The executive producer of the podcast is Hunter Lewis. You can subscribe on iTunes, Google Play, and YouTube. We appreciate your positive feedback and comments. Thank you so much for listening, and we'll talk to you next time.